This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Start With Why, How Great Leaders Inspire Everyone to Take Action. Written and read by Simon Sinek.
There are leaders, and there are those who lead. Leaders hold a position of power or influence. Those who lead inspire us. Whether individuals or organizations, we follow those who lead not because we have to, but because we want to. We follow those who lead not for them, but for ourselves. This is a book for those who want to inspire others or for those who want to find someone to inspire them. Introduction. Why start with why? This book is about a naturally occurring pattern, a way of thinking, acting, and communicating that gives some leaders the ability to inspire those around them. Although these natural-born leaders may have come into the world with a predisposition to inspire, the ability is not reserved for them exclusively. We can all learn this pattern. With a little discipline, any leader or organization can inspire others, both inside and outside their organization, in order to help advance their ideas and their vision. We can all learn to lead. The goal of this book is not to simply try to fix the things that aren't working. Rather, I wrote this book as a guide to focus on and amplify the things that already work. I do not aim to upset the solutions offered by others. Most of the answers we get, when based on sound evidence, are perfectly valid. However, if we're starting with the wrong questions, if we don't understand the cause, then even the right answers will always steer us wrong eventually. The truth, you see, is always revealed eventually. The stories that follow are of those individuals and organizations that naturally embody this pattern. They are the ones that start with why. Section 1. The goal was ambitious. Public interest was high. Experts were eager to contribute. Money was readily available. Armed with every ingredient for success, Samuel Pierpont Langley set out in the early 1900s to be the first man to pilot an airplane. Highly regarded, he was a senior officer at the Smithsonian Institution, a mathematics professor who also had worked at Harvard. His friends included some of the most powerful men in government and business, including Andrew Carnegie and Alexander Graham Bell. Langley was given $50,000 from the War Department to fund his project, a tremendous amount of money for the time. He pulled together the best minds of the day, a veritable dream team of talent and know-how. Langley and his team used the finest materials, and the press followed them everywhere. People all over the country were riveted to this story, waiting to read that he had achieved his goal. With the team he had gathered and ample resources, his success was guaranteed. Or was it? A few hundred miles away, Wilbur and Orville Wright were working on their own flying machine. Their passion to fly was so intense that it inspired the enthusiasm and commitment of a dedicated group in their hometown of Dayton, Ohio. There was no funding for the venture, no government grants, no high-level connections. Not a single person on the team had an advanced degree or even a college education, not even Wilbur or Orville. But the team banded together in a humble bicycle shop and made their vision real. On December 17, 1903, a small group witnessed a man take flight for the first time in history. How did the Wright brothers succeed where a better equipped, better funded, and better educated team could not? It wasn't luck. Both the Wright brothers and Langley were highly motivated. Both had a strong work ethic. Both had keen scientific minds. They were pursuing exactly the same goal, but only the Wright brothers were able to inspire those around them and truly lead their team to develop a technology that would change the world. Only the Wright brothers started with why. Section 2. In 1965, students on the campus of UC Berkeley were the first to publicly burn their draft cards to protest America's involvement in the Vietnam War. Northern California was a hotbed of anti-government and anti-establishment sentiment. Footage of clashes and riots in Berkeley and in Oakland were beamed around the globe, fueling sympathetic movements across the United States and in Europe. But it wasn't until 1976, nearly 3 years after the end of America's military involvement in the Vietnam conflict, that a different revolution ignited. They aimed to make an impact, a very big impact, even challenged the way people perceived how the world worked. But these young revolutionaries did not throw stones or take up arms against an authoritarian regime. Instead, they decided to beat the system at its own game. For Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs, the co-founders of Apple Computer, the battlefield was business, and the weapon of choice was the personal computer. The personal computer revolution was beginning to brew when Wozniak built the Apple I. Just starting to gain attention, the technology was primarily seen as a tool for business. Computers were too complicated and out of the price range of the average individual. But Wozniak, a man not motivated by money, envisioned a nobler purpose for the technology. He saw the personal computer as a way for the little man to take on the corporation. If he could figure out a way to get it in the hands of the individual, he thought, the computer would give nearly anyone the ability to perform many of the same functions as a vastly better resourced company. The personal computer could level the playing field and change the way the world operated. Woz designed the Apple I and improved the technology with the Apple II to be affordable and simple to use. No matter how visionary or how brilliant, a great idea or a great product isn't worth much if no one buys it. Wozniak's best friend at the time, the 21-year-old Steve Jobs, knew exactly what to do. Though he had experience selling surplus electronics parts, Jobs would prove to be much more than a good salesman. He wanted to do something significant in the world, and building a company was how he was going to do it. Apple was the tool he used to ignite his revolution. In their first year in business, with only one product, Apple made $1 million in revenues. By year two, they did $10 million in sales, and in their fourth year, they sold $100 million worth of computers. And in just 6 years, Apple Computer was a billion-dollar company with over 3,000 employees. Jobs and Woz were not the only people taking part in the personal computer revolution. They weren't the only smart guys in business. In fact, they didn't know much about business at all. What made Apple special was not their ability to build such a fast-growth company. It wasn't their ability to think differently about personal computers. What made Apple special is that they've been able to repeat the pattern over and over and over. Unlike any of their competitors, Apple has successfully challenged conventional thinking within the computer industry, the small electronics industry, the music industry, the mobile phone industry, and the broader entertainment industry. And the reason is simple. Apple inspires. Apple starts with why. Section 3. He was not perfect. He had his complexities. He was not the only one who suffered in a pre-civil rights America, and there were plenty of other charismatic speakers. But Martin Luther King Jr. had a gift. He knew how to inspire people. Dr. King knew that if the civil rights movement was to succeed, if there was to be a real, lasting change, it would take more than him and his closest allies. It would take more than rousing words and eloquent speeches. It would take people. Tens of thousands of average citizens united by a single vision to change the country. At 11 a.m. on August 28, 1963, they would send a message to Washington that it was time for America to steer a new course. The organizers of the civil rights movement did not send out thousands of invitations, nor was there a website to check the date. But the people came, and they kept coming and coming. All told, 250,000 people descended on the nation's capital in time to hear the words immortalized by history, delivered by the man who would lead a movement that would change America forever. I have a dream. The ability to attract so many people from across the country, of all colors and races, to join together on the right day, at the right time, took something special. Although others knew what had to change in America to bring about civil rights for all, it was Martin Luther King who was able to inspire a country to change not just for the good of a minority, but for the good of everyone. Martin Luther King started with why. There are leaders and there are those who lead. With only 6% market share in the United States and about 3% worldwide, Apple is not a leading manufacturer of home computers. Yet the company leads the computer industry and is now a leader in other industries as well. Martin Luther King's experiences were not unique, yet he inspired a nation to change. The Wright brothers were not the strongest contenders in the race to take the first manned powered flight, but they led us into a new era of aviation, and in doing so, completely changed the world we live in. Their goals were not different from anyone else's, and their systems and processes were easily replicated. Yet the Wright brothers, Apple, and Martin Luther King stand out among their peers. They stand apart from the norm, and their impact is not easily copied. They are members of a very select group of leaders who do something very, very special. They inspire us. Just about every person or organization needs to motivate others to act for some reason or another. Some want to motivate a purchase decision. Others are looking for a support or a vote. Still others are keen to motivate the people around them to work harder or smarter or just follow the rules. The ability to motivate people is not in itself difficult. It is usually tied to some external factor. Tempting incentives or the threat of punishment will often elicit the behavior we desire. General Motors, for example, so successfully motivated people to buy their products that they sold more cars than any other automaker in the world for over 77 years. Though they were the leaders in the industry, they did not lead. Great leaders, in contrast, are able to inspire people to act. Those who are able to inspire give people a sense of purpose or belonging that has little to do with any external incentive or benefit to be gained. Those who truly lead are able to create a following of people who act not because they were swayed, but because they were inspired. For those who are inspired, the motivation to act is deeply personal. They are less likely to be swayed by incentives. Those who are inspired are willing to pay a premium or endure inconvenience, even personal suffering. Those who are able to inspire will create a following of people, supporters, voters, customers, workers, who act for the good of the whole, not because they have to, but because they want to. Though relatively few in number, the organizations and leaders with the natural ability to inspire us come in all shapes and sizes. They can be found both in public and private sectors. They are in all sorts of industries, selling to consumers or to other businesses. Regardless of where they exist, they all have a disproportionate amount of influence in their own industries. They have the most loyal customers and the most loyal employees. They tend to be more profitable than others in their industry. They are more innovative, and more importantly, they are able to sustain all these things over the long term. Many of them change industries. Some of them even change the world. The Wright brothers, Apple, and Dr. King are just three examples. Harley-Davidson, Disney, and Southwest Airlines are three more. John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan were also able to inspire. No matter from where they hail, they all have something in common. All the inspiring leaders and companies, regardless of size or industry, think, act, and communicate exactly alike. And it's the complete opposite of everyone else. What if we could all learn to think, act, and communicate like those who inspire? Imagine a world in which the ability to inspire is practiced not just by a chosen few, but by the majority. Studies show that over 80% of Americans do not have their dream job. If more knew how to build organizations that inspire, we could live in a world in which that statistic was reversed, a world in which over 80% of people loved their jobs. People who love going to work are more productive and more creative. They go home happier and have happier families. They treat their colleagues and their clients and their customers better. Inspired employees make for stronger companies and stronger economies. That is why I wrote this book. I hope to inspire others to do the things that inspire them so that together we may build the companies, the economy, and the world in which trust and loyalty are the norm, not the exception. This book is not designed to tell you what to do or how to do it. Its goal is not to give you a course of action. Its goal is to offer you the cause of action. for those who have an open mind for new ideas, who seek to create long-lasting success, and who believe that your success requires the aid of others, I offer you a challenge. From now on, start with why. Part 1. A world that doesn't start with why. Chapter 1. Assume you know. On a cold January day, a 43-year-old man was sworn in as the chief executive of his country. By his side stood his predecessor, a famous general, who, 15 years earlier, had commanded his nation's armed forces in a war that resulted in the defeat of Germany. This young leader was raised in the Roman Catholic faith. He spent the next 5 hours watching parades in his honor and stayed up celebrating until 3 o'clock in the morning. You know who I'm describing, right? It's January 30th, 1933, and I'm describing Adolf Hitler, and not, as most people would assume, John F. Kennedy. The point is, we make assumptions. We make assumptions about the world around us based on sometimes incomplete or false information. In this case, the information I offered was incomplete. Many of you were convinced that I was describing John F. Kennedy until I added one minor little detail, the date. This is important because our behavior is affected by our assumptions or perceived truths. We make decisions based on what we think we know. It wasn't too long ago that the majority of people believed that the world is flat. This perceived truth impacted behavior. During this period, there was very little exploration. People feared that if they traveled too far, they might fall off the edge of the earth. So, for the most part, they stayed put. It wasn't until that minor little detail was revealed that the world is actually round, that behaviors changed on a massive scale. Upon this discovery, societies began to traverse the planet. Trade routes were established, spices were traded. New ideas like mathematics were shared between societies, which unleashed all kinds of innovations and advancements. The correction of a simple false assumption moved the human race forward. Now consider how organizations are formed and how decisions are made. Do we really know why some organizations succeed and why others don't? Or do we just assume? No matter your definition of success, hitting a target stock price, making a certain amount of money, meeting a revenue or profit goal, getting a big promotion, starting your own company, feeding the poor, winning public office, how we go about achieving our goals is very similar. Some of us just wing it. But most of us try, at least, to gather some data so we can make some educated decisions. Sometimes this gathering process is formal, like conducting polls or market research. And sometimes it's informal, like asking our friends and colleagues for advice or looking back on our own personal experiences to provide some perspective. Regardless of the process or the goals, we all want to make educated decisions. More importantly, we all want to make the right decisions. As we all know, however, not all decisions work out to be the right ones, regardless of the amount of data we collect. Sometimes the impact of these wrong decisions is minor, and sometimes it can be catastrophic. Whatever the result, we make decisions based on a perception of the world that may not, in fact, be completely accurate. Just as so many of you were certain that I was describing John F. Kennedy at the beginning of this section, you were certain you were right. You might have even bet money on it, a behavior based on an assumption. Certain, that is, until I offered that little detail of the date. Not only bad decisions are made on false assumptions. Sometimes when things go right, we think we know why. But do we really? That the result went the way you wanted does not mean you can repeat it over and over. I have a friend who invests some of his own money. Whenever he does well, it's because of his brains and ability to pick the right stocks, at least according to him. But when he loses money, he always blames the market. Now, I have no issue with either line of logic, but either his success and failure hinge upon his own prescience or blindness, or they hinge upon good and bad luck. But it can't be both. So how can we ensure that all our decisions will yield the best results for the reasons that are fully within our control? Logic dictates that more information and data are key, and that's exactly what we do. We read books, we attend conferences, listen to podcasts, and ask friends and colleagues, all with the purpose of finding out more so we can figure out what to do or how to act. The problem is, we've all been in situations in which we have all the data and get lots of good advice, but things still don't quite go right. Or maybe the impact lasted for only a short time, or something happened that we could not foresee. A quick note to all of you who correctly guessed Adolf Hitler at the beginning of this section. The details I gave are the same for both Hitler and John F. Kennedy. It could have been either. You have to be careful what you think you know. Assumptions, you see, even when based on sound research, can lead us astray. Intuitively, we understand this. We understand that even with mountains of data and good advice, if things don't go as expected, it's probably because we missed one sometimes small but vital detail. In these cases, we go back to all our sources, maybe seek out some new ones, and try to figure out what to do. And the whole process begins again. More data, however, doesn't always help, especially if a flawed assumption set the whole process in motion in the first place. There are other factors that must be considered, factors that exist outside our rational, analytical, information-hungry brains. There are times in which we had no data, or chose to ignore the advice or information we had, and just went with our gut. And things worked out just fine, sometimes even better than expected. This dance between gut and rational decision-making pretty much covers how we conduct business and even live our lives. We can continue to slice and dice all the options in every direction, but at the end of all the good advice and all the compelling evidence, we're left where we started. How to explain or decide a course of action that yields a desired effect that is repeatable. How can we have 2020 foresight? There's a wonderful story of a group of American car executives who went to Japan to see a Japanese assembly line. At the end of the line, the doors are put on the hinges, the same as in America, but something was missing. In the United States, a line worker would take a rubber mallet and tap the edges of the door to ensure that it fit perfectly. In Japan, that job didn't seem to exist. Confused, the American auto executives asked at what point they made sure the door fit perfectly. Their Japanese guide looked at them and smiled sheepishly. "We make sure it fits when we design it," he said. In the Japanese auto plant, they didn't examine the problem and accumulate data to figure out the best solution. They engineered the outcome they wanted from the beginning. If they didn't achieve their desired outcome, they understood it was because of the decision they made at the start of the process. At the end of the day, the doors on an American-made car and a Japanese-made car appeared to fit when each rolled off the assembly lines. Except the Japanese didn't need to employ someone to hammer the doors, nor did they need to buy any rubber mallets. More importantly, the Japanese doors are likely to last longer, and maybe even be more structurally sound in an accident. All this for no other reason than they ensured the pieces fit from the start. What the American automakers did with their rubber mallets is a metaphor for how so many people and organizations lead. When faced with a result that doesn't go according to plan, a series of perfectly effective short-term tactics are used until the desired outcome is achieved. But how structurally sound are these solutions? So many organizations function in a world of tangible goals and the mallets to achieve them. The ones that achieve more, however, the ones that get more out of fewer people and fewer resources, the ones with an outsized amount of influence, build the products and companies, and even recruit people that all fit based on the original intention. Even though the outcome may look the same, great leaders understand the value in the things we cannot see. Every instruction we give, every course of action we set, every result we desire starts with the same thing, a decision. There are those who decide to manipulate the door to fit the achieved and desired result, and there are those who start from somewhere very different. Though both courses of action may yield similar short-term results, it's what we can't see that makes long-term success more predictable for only one. The one that understood why the doors need to fit by design and not by default. Chapter 2. Carrots and Sticks. Manipulation versus inspiration. There's barely a product or service on the market today that customers can't buy from someone else for about the same price, about the same quality, about the same level of service and about the same features. If you truly have a first mover's advantage, it's probably lost in a matter of months anyway. If you offer something truly novel, someone else will come up with something similar or maybe even better. But if you ask most businesses why their customers are their customers, most will tell you it's because of their superior quality, features, price, or service. In other words, most companies have no clue why their customers are their customers. This is a fascinating realization. If companies don't know why their customers are their customers, odds are good that they don't know why their employees are their employees either. If most companies don't really know why their customers are their customers, or why their employees are their employees, then how do they know what to do, or how to attract more employees and encourage loyalty among those they already have? The reality is, most businesses today are making decisions based on a set of incomplete, or worse, completely flawed assumptions about what's driving their business. There are only two ways to influence human behavior. You can manipulate it, or you can inspire it. When I say manipulation, this is not necessarily a pejorative. It's a very common and fairly benign tactic. In fact, many of us have been doing it since we were young. "I'll be your best friend" is the highly effective negotiating tactic employed by generations of children to obtain something they want from a peer. And as any child who has ever handed over their candy, hoping for a new best friend will tell you, it works. From business to politics, manipulations run rampant in all forms of sales and marketing. Typical manipulations include things like dropping the price, running a promotion, using fear, peer pressure, or aspirational messages. And promising innovation to influence behavior, be it a purchase, or a vote, or support. When companies or organizations do not have a clear sense of why their customers are their customers, they tend to rely on a disproportionate number of manipulations to get what they need. And for good reason. Manipulations work. Price. Many companies are reluctant to play the price game, but they do so because they know it's effective. So effective, in fact, that the temptation can sometimes be overwhelming. There are very few professional services firms that, when faced with an opportunity to land a big piece of business, haven't just dropped their price to make the deal happen. No matter how they rationalize it to themselves or their clients, price is a highly effective manipulation. Drop your prices low enough, and people will buy from you. We see it at the end of the retail season when products are, quote-unquote, priced to move. Drop the price low enough, and the shelves will very quickly clear to make room for the next season's products. Playing the price game, however, can come at a tremendous cost and can create a significant dilemma for the company. For the seller, selling based on price is like heroin. The short-term gain is fantastic, but the more you do it, the harder it becomes to kick the habit. Once buyers get used to paying lower than average prices, it's very hard to get them to pay more later. And the sellers, facing overwhelming pressure to push their prices lower and lower and lower in order to compete, find their margins cut slimmer and slimmer. This only drives a need to sell more to compensate. And the quickest way to do that is lower the prices again. And so the downward spiral of price addiction sets in. In the drug world, we call these addicts junkies. In the business world, we call them commodities. Insurance, home computers, mobile phone service, any number of packaged goods, the list of commodities created by the price game goes on and on and on. In nearly every circumstance, the companies that are forced to treat their products as commodities brought it upon themselves. I cannot debate that dropping the price is not a perfectly legitimate way of driving business. The challenge is staying profitable when you do it. Walmart seems to be an exception to the rule. They have built a phenomenally successful business playing the price game, but it also came at a high cost. Scale helped Walmart avoid the inherent weakness of a price strategy, but the company's obsession with price, above all else, has left it scandal-ridden and hurt its reputation. And every one of the company's scandals was born from its attempts to keep costs down so it could afford to offer such low prices. Price always costs something. The question is, how much are you willing to pay for the money you make? Promotions. General Motors had a bold goal: to lead the American automotive industry in market share. In the 1950s, there were four choices of car manufacturer in the United States: GM, Ford, Chrysler, and AMC. Before foreign automakers entered the field, GM dominated. New competition, as one would expect, made that goal harder to maintain. I don't need to provide any data to explain how much has changed in the auto industry in the past 50 years. But General Motors held fast through most of the last century and maintained its prize dominance. Since 1990, however, Toyota's share of the U.S. market has more than doubled. By 2007, Toyota's share had climbed to 16.3% from only 7.8%. During the same period, GM saw its U.S. market share drop dramatically from 35% in 1990 to 23.8% in 2007. And in early 2008, the unthinkable happened. U.S. consumers bought more foreign-made automobiles than ones made in America. Since the 1990s, faced with this onslaught of competition from Japan, GM and other U.S. automakers have scrambled to offer incentives aimed at helping them hold to their dwindling market share. Heavily promoted with advertising, GM, for one, has offered cashback incentives of between $500 and $7,000 to customers who bought their cars and trucks. For a long time, the promotions worked brilliantly. GM sales were on the rise again. But in the long term, the incentives only helped to dramatically erode GM's profit margins and put them in a deep hole. In 2007, GM lost $729 per vehicle sold, and in large part this was due to the incentives they offered. Realizing that the model was unsustainable, GM announced it would reduce the amount of the cashback incentives it offered, and with that reduction, sales plummeted. No cash, no customers. The auto industry had effectively created cashback junkies out of customers, building an expectation that there's no such thing as full price. Whether it's two for one or free toy inside, promotions are such common manipulations that we often forget that we're being manipulated in the first place. The next time you're in the market for a digital camera, for example, pay attention to how you make your decision. You'll easily find two or three cameras with the specifications you need: size, number of megapixels, comparable price, good brand name. But perhaps one has a promotion, a free carrying case, or a free memory card. Given the relative parity of the features and benefits, that little something extra is sometimes all it takes to tip the scale. In the business-to-business world, promotions are called value added. But the principles are the same. Give something away for free to reduce the risk so that someone will do business with you over your competition. And like price, promotions work. The manipulative nature of promotions is so well established in the retail world that the industry has even named one of the principles. They call it breakage. Breakage measures the percentage of customers who fail to take advantage of a promotion and end up paying full price for the product instead. This typically happens when buyers don't bother performing the necessary steps to claim their rebates, a process purposely kept complicated or inconvenient to increase the likelihood of mistakes or inaction, to keep that breakage number up. Rebates typically require the customer to send in a copy of a receipt, cut out a barcode from the packaging, and painstakingly fill out a rebate form with details about the product and how it was purchased and where you got it. Sending in the wrong part of the box or leaving out a detail on the application can delay the rebate for weeks, months, or void it altogether. The rebate industry also has a name for the number of customers who just don't bother to apply for the rebate, or who never cash in that rebate check they receive. That's called slippage. For businesses, the short-term benefits of rebates and other manipulations are clear. A rebate lures customers to pay full price for a product that they may have considered buying, if only because of the prospect of a partial refund. But nearly 40% of all those customers never get the lower price that they thought they were paying. Call it a tax on the disorganized, but retailers rely on it. Regulators have stepped up their scrutiny of the rebate industry, but with only limited success. The rebate process remains cumbersome, and that means free money to the seller. Manipulation at its best. But at what cost? Fear. If someone were to hold up a bank with a banana in his pocket, he would be charged with armed robbery. Clearly, no victim was in any danger of being shot, but it is the belief that the robber had a real gun that is considered by the law. And for good reason. Knowing full well that fear will motivate them to comply with his demands, the robber took steps to make his victims afraid. Fear, real or perceived, is arguably the most powerful manipulation of them all. No one ever got fired for hiring IBM, it said, describing a behavior completely born out of fear. An employee in a procurement department tasked with finding the best suppliers for a company turns down a better product at a better price simply because it's from a smaller company or lesser-known brand. Fear, whether it's real or perceived, that his job would be on the line if something went wrong, was enough to make this guy ignore the express purpose of his job, even do something that is not in the company's best interest. When fear is employed, facts are incidental. Deeply seated in our biological drive to survive, that emotion cannot be quickly wiped away with facts and figures. This is how terrorism works. It's not the statistical probability that one could get hurt by a terrorist, but it's the fear that it might happen that cripples a population. A powerful manipulator, fear is often used with far less nefarious motivations. We use fear to raise our kids. We use fear to motivate people to obey a code of ethics. Fear is regularly used in public service ads, say to promote child safety or AIDS awareness, or the need to wear seatbelts. Anyone who was watching television in the 1980s got a heavy dose of anti-drug advertising, including one often mimicked public service ad from a federal program to combat drug abuse amongst teenagers. "This is your brain," the man's voice said, as he held up a pristine white egg. Then he cracked the egg into a frying pan of spattering hot oil. "This is your brain on drugs. Any questions?" And another ad, intended to scare the hell out of any brash teenager. "Cocaine doesn't make you sexy. It makes you dead." Likewise, when politicians say that their opponent will raise taxes or cut spending on law enforcement, or the evening news alerts you that your health or security at risk unless you tune in at 11, both are attempting to seed fear among voters and viewers, respectively. Businesses also use fear to agitate the insecurity we all have in order to sell products. The idea is that if you don't buy the product or service, something bad could happen to you. "Every 36 seconds, someone dies of a heart attack," states an ad for a local cardiac specialist. "Do you have radon? Your neighbor does," reads the ad on the side of a truck for some company selling a home pollution inspection service. And of course, the insurance industry would like to sell you term life insurance before it's too late. Aspirations. "Quitting smoking is the easiest thing I've ever done," said Mark Twain. "I've done it hundreds of times." If fear motivates us to move away from something horrible, aspirational messages tempt us towards something desirable. Marketers often talk about the importance of being aspirational, offering someone something they desire to achieve, or the ability to get something more easily with a particular product or service. 6 steps to a happier life, for example. "Work those abs to your dream dress size. In 6 short weeks, you can be rich." All these messages manipulate. They tempt us with the things we want to have or to be the person we wish we were. Though positive in nature, aspirational messages are most effective with those who lack discipline or have a nagging fear or insecurity that they don't have the ability themselves to achieve their dreams on their own, which, at various times, for various reasons, is all of us. I always joke that you can get someone to buy a gym membership with an aspirational message, but to get them to go 3 days a week, that requires a bit of inspiration. Someone who lives a healthy lifestyle and is in a habit of exercising does not respond to 6 easy steps to losing weight. It's those who don't have the lifestyle that are most susceptible. It's not news that a lot of people try diet after diet after diet in an attempt to get the body of their dreams. And no matter the regime that they choose, each comes with the qualification that regular exercise and a balanced diet will help boost the results. In other words, discipline. Gym memberships tend to rise about 12% every January as people try to fulfill their New Year's aspiration to live a healthier lifestyle. Yet only a fraction of those aspiring fitness buffs are still attending the gym by the end of the year. Aspirational messages can spur behavior, but for most, it won't last. Aspirational messages are not only effective in the consumer market, they also work quite well in business-to-business transactions. Managers of companies, big or small, all want to do well, so they make decisions, hire consultants, and implement systems to help them achieve that desired outcome. But all too often, it is not the systems that fail, but the ability to maintain them. I can speak from personal experience here. I have implemented a lot of systems or practices over the years to help me achieve the success to which I aspire, only to find myself back to my old habits 2 weeks later. I aspire for a system that will help me avoid implementing systems to meet all my aspirations, but I probably wouldn't be able to follow it for very long. The short-term response to long-term desires is alive and well in the corporate world as well. A management consultant friend of mine was hired by a billion-dollar company to help it fulfill its goals and aspirations. The problem was, she explained, no matter the issue, the company's managers were always drawn to the quicker, cheaper option over the better long-term solution. Just like the habitual dieter, they never had the time or money to do it right the first time, but they always seemed to have the time and money to do it again. Peer pressure. 4 out of 5 dentists prefer Trident, touts the chewing gum advertisement, in an attempt to get you to try their product. A double-blind study conducted at a top university concluded, pushes a late-night infomercial, if the product is good enough for professionals, it's good enough for you, the advertising eggs on. With over 1 million satisfied customers and counting, teases another ad. These are all forms of peer pressure. When marketers report that a majority of a population or a group of experts prefers their product over another, they are attempting to sway the buyer to believe whatever they are selling is better. The peer pressure works because we believe that the majority or the experts might know more than we do. Peer pressure works not because the majority or the experts are always right, but because we fear that we may be wrong. Celebrity endorsements are sometimes used to add peer pressure to the sales pitch. If he uses it, we're supposed to think, it must be good. This makes sense when we hear Tiger Woods endorse Nike golf products or Titleist golf balls. Woods' deal with Nike is actually credited for putting the company on the map in the golf world. But Tiger has also endorsed General Motors, management consulting services, credit cards, food, and a Tag Heuer watch designed, quote, especially for the golfer. The watch, incidentally, can withstand a 5,000G shock, a level of shock more likely experienced by the golf ball than the golfer. But Tiger endorsed it, so it must be good. Celebrity endorsements are also used to appeal to our aspirations and our desires to be like them. Sam Waterston of Law & Order fame, for example, sells online trading for TD Ameritrade. But for his celebrity, it's uncertain what an actor famed for convicting homicidal maniacs does for a brand. I guess he's trustworthy? Impressionable youth are not the only ones subject to peer pressure. Most of us have probably had an experience of being pressured by a salesman. Have you ever had a sales rep try to sell you some office solution by telling you that 70% of your competitors are using their service, so why aren't you? But what if 70% of your competitors are idiots? Or what if 70% were given a price so low that they just couldn't resist? The practice is designed to do one thing and one thing only, to pressure you to buy, to make you feel that you might be missing out on something or that everyone else knows something that you don't. Better to go with the majority, right? To quote my mother, if your friends put their head in the oven, would you do that too? Sadly, if Michael Jordan or Tiger Woods was paid to do just that, it might actually start a trend. Novelty, or as companies like to call it, innovation. In a major innovation in design and engineering, Motorola has created a phone of firsts, read a 2004 press release that announced the launch of the mobile phone manufacturer's newest entry to the ultra-competitive mobile phone market. The combination of metals, such as aircraft-grade aluminum, with new advances, such as an internal antenna and a chemically etched keypad, led to the formation of a device that measures just 13.9 millimeters thin. And it worked. Millions of people rushed to get one. Celebrities flashed their razors all over the red carpet. Even a prime minister or two was seen talking on one. Having sold over 50 million units, few could argue that the razor wasn't a huge success for Motorola. By surpassing current mobile expectations, the Razr represents Motorola's history of delivering revolutionary innovations, said former Motorola CEO Ed Zander of his new Wunder product, while setting a new bar for future products coming out of the wireless industry. This one product was a huge financial success for Motorola. It was truly an innovation of monumental proportions. Or was it? Less than 4 years later, Zander was forced out of his own job. The stock traded at 50% of its average value since the launch of the Razr, and Motorola's competitors had easily surpassed the Razr's features and functionalities with equally innovative new phones. Motorola was once again rendered just another mobile phone manufacturer, fighting for its piece of the pie. Like so many before it, the company confused innovation with novelty. Real innovation changes the course of industries or even society. The light bulb, the microwave oven, the fax machine, iTunes. These are true innovations that changed how we conduct business, alter how we live our lives, and in the case of iTunes, challenged an industry to completely reevaluate its business model. Adding a camera to a mobile phone, for example, is not an innovation. A great feature, for sure, but not industry-altering. With this revised definition in mind, even Motorola's own description of its new product becomes just a list of a few great features. A metal case, a hidden antenna, a flat keypad and a thin phone, hardly, quote, revolutionary innovation. Motorola had successfully designed the latest shiny object for people to get excited about, at least until someone came out with a new one. And that's the reason these features are more of a novelty than an innovation. They are added in an attempt to differentiate but not reinvent. It's not a bad thing, but it can't be counted on to add any long-term value. Novelty can drive sales, the Razr proved it. But the impact does not last. If a company adds too many novel ideas too often, it can have a similar impact on the product or category as the price game. In an attempt to differentiate with more features, the products start to look and feel more like commodities, and, like price, the need to add yet another product to the line to compensate for the commoditization ends in a downward spiral. In the 1970s, for example, there were only two types of Colgate toothpaste. But as competition increased, Colgate sales started to slip. So the company introduced a new product that included a new feature, the addition of fluoride perhaps, then another, whitening, tartar control, sparkles, stripes. Each innovation certainly helped boost sales, for a while at least, and so the cycle continued. Guess how many different types of toothpaste Colgate has for you to choose from today? 32. Today, there are 32 different types of Colgate toothpaste, excluding the four they make for children. And given how each company responds to the innovations of the other, that means that Colgate's competitors are also selling a similar number of variants that offer about the same quality, about the same benefits, at about the same price. There are literally dozens and dozens of toothpastes to choose from, yet there is no data to show that Americans are brushing their teeth now more than they were in the 1970s. Thanks to all this innovation, it has become almost impossible to know which toothpaste is right for you. So much so that even Colgate themselves offer a link on their website called Need Help Deciding? If Colgate needs to help us pick one of their products because there are too many variations, how are we supposed to decide ourselves when we go to the supermarket without their website to help us? Once again, this is an example of the newest set of shiny objects designed to encourage a trial or a purchase. What companies cleverly disguise as innovation is in fact novelty. And it's not only packaged goods that rely on novelty to lure customers. It's a common practice in other industries too. It works, but rarely, if ever, does the strategy cement any loyal relationships. Apple's iPhone has since replaced the Motorola Razr as the most popular must-have new mobile phone. Removing all the buttons and putting a touchscreen is not what makes the iPhone innovative, however. Those are brilliant new features, but others can and have copied these things, and it wouldn't redefine the category. There is something else that Apple did that is vastly more significant. Apple is not only leading how mobile phones are designed, but in typical Apple fashion, they are leading how the industry functions. In the mobile phone industry, it is the service provider, not the phone manufacturer, that determines all the features and benefits that the phone can offer. T-Mobile, Verizon Wireless, Sprint, and AT&T all dictate to Motorola, Nokia, Ericsson, LG, and others what the phones will do. Then Apple showed up. They announced that they would tell the service provider what the phone would do and not the other way around. AT&T was the only one that agreed, thus earning the company the exclusive deal to offer the new technology. That's the kind of shift that will impact the industry for many years and will extend far beyond a few years of stock boost for the shiny new product. And that's pretty novel. The price you pay for the money you make. I cannot dispute that manipulations work. Every one of them indeed can help influence behavior, and every one of them can help a company become quite successful. But there are trade-offs. Not a single one of them breeds loyalty. Over the course of time, they cost more and more. The gains are only short-term, and they increase the level of stress both for the buyer and for the seller. If you have exceptionally deep pockets or are looking to achieve only a short-term gain with no consideration for the long-term, then these strategies and tactics are perfect for you. Beyond the business world, manipulations are the norm in politics today as well. Just as manipulations can drive a sale but not create loyalty, so too can they help a candidate get elected, but they do not create a foundation for leadership. Leadership requires people to stick with you through thick and thin. Leadership is the ability to rally people, not for a single event, but for years. In business, leadership means that customers will continue to support your company even when you slip up. If manipulation is the only strategy, what happens the next time a purchase decision is required? What happens after the big election is won? There is a big difference between repeat business and loyalty. Repeat business is when people do business with you over and over and over again. Loyalty is when people are willing to turn down a better product, at a better price, or suffer inconvenience to continue to do business with you. Loyal customers often don't even bother to research the competition or entertain other options. Loyalty is not easily won. Repeat business, however, is. All it takes is more manipulations. Manipulative techniques have become such a mainstay in American business today that it has become virtually impossible for some to kick the habit. Like any addiction, the drive is not to get sober, but to find the next fix, faster and more frequently. And as good as short-term highs may feel, they have a deleterious impact on the long-term health of any organization. Addicted to the short-term results, business today has largely become a series of quick fixes added on one after the other after the other. The short-term tactics have become so sophisticated that an entire economy has developed to service the manipulations. Equipped with statistics and quasi-science, direct marketing companies, for example, offer calculations about which words will get the best results on each piece of direct mail they send out. Those that offer mail-in rebates know that the incentive works, and they know that the higher the rebate, the more effective it is. They also know the cost that goes along with those rebates. To make them profitable, manufacturers rely on those breakage and slippage numbers staying above a certain threshold, just like our trusty drug addict, whose behavior is reinforced by how good the short-term high feels. The temptation to make the qualifications of the rebate more obscure or more cumbersome so as to reduce the number of qualified applicants can be overwhelming for some. Samsung, the electronics manufacturer, got really good at the kind of fine print that makes rebates so profitable for companies. In the early 2000s, the company offered rebates of up to $150 on a variety of electronic products, stipulating in the fine print, however, that the rebate was limited to one per address, a requirement that would have sounded reasonable enough to anyone at the time. Yet, in practice, it effectively disqualified all customers who lived in apartment buildings, where more than one resident had already applied for the same rebate. More than 4,000 Samsung customers, lured by the cash back, received notices denying them the rebates on these grounds. The practice was brought to the attention of the New York Attorney General, and in 2004, Samsung was ordered to pay $200,000 in rebate claims to apartment dwellers. This is an extreme case of a company that got caught, but the rebate game of cutting out UPC symbols, filling out forms, and doing it all before a deadline is alive and well. How can a company claim to be customer-focused when they are so comfortable measuring the number of customers who will fail to realize any of the savings they promise? Manipulations lead to transactions, not loyalty. It's simple, explains the TV infomercial. Simply put your old gold jewelry in the prepaid insured envelope, and we'll send you a check for the value of the gold in just 2 days. MyGoldEnvelope.com is one of the leaders in this industry, serving as a broker for gold to be sent to a refinery, melted down, and reintroduced into the commodities market. When Douglas Feirstein and Michael Moran started the company, they wanted to be the best in the business. They wanted to transform this industry that had a reputation of a back-alley pawn shop and give it a bit of a Tiffany's sheen. They invested money in making the experience perfect. They worked to make the customer service experience ideal. They were both successful entrepreneurs and knew the value of building a brand and strong customer experiences. They spent a lot of money trying to get this balance just right, and they made sure to explain their difference in their direct response advertising on various local and national cable stations. Better than similar offers, they'd say. And they were right, but the investment didn't pay off as expected. A few months later, Feirstein and Moran made a significant discovery. Almost all of their customers did business with them only once. They had a transactional business, yet they were trying to make it so much more than that. So they stopped trying to make their service better than similar offers, and instead settled with good. Given that most people were not going to become repeat customers, there weren't really going to be any head-to-head comparisons made with the other services. All they needed to do was drive a purchase decision and offer a pleasant enough experience that people would recommend it to a friend. Any more was just unnecessary. Once the owners of MyGoldEnvelope.com realized that they didn't need to invest in the things that build loyalty, if all they had to do was drive the transaction, their business would become vastly more efficient and vastly more profitable. And that's exactly what happened. For transactions that occur an average of once, carrots and sticks are the best way to elicit the desired behavior. When the police offer a reward, they are not looking to nurture a relationship with the witness or the tipster. It is just a single transaction. When you lose your kitten and offer a reward to get it back, you don't need to have a lasting relationship with the person returning it. You just want your cat back. Manipulations are a perfectly valid strategy for driving a transaction, or for any behavior that only is required once or on rare occasions. The rewards that the police use are designed to incentivize witnesses to come forward to provide tips or evidence that may lead to an arrest. And, like any promotion, the manipulation will work if the incentive feels high enough to mitigate the risk. In any circumstance in which a person or organization wants more than a single transaction, however, if there is a hope for a loyal, lasting relationship, manipulations just do not help. Does a politician want your vote? Or does he or she want a lifetime of support and loyalty from you? The American car industry learned the hard way the high cost of relying on manipulations to build a business when loyalty was what they really needed to nurture. While manipulations may be a viable strategy when times are good and money is flush, a change in market conditions made them too expensive. When the oil crisis of 2008 hit, the auto industry's promotions and incentives became untenable. The same thing happened in the 1970s. You'd think they would have learned something from that. In this case, how long the manipulations could produce short-term gains was defined by the length of time the economy could sustain the strategy. This is a fundamentally weak platform upon which to build a business, an assumption of never-ending boom. Though loyal customers are less tempted by other offers and incentives, in good times, the free flow of business makes it hard to recognize their value. It's in the tough times that loyal customers matter most. Manipulations work, but they cost money. Lots of money. When the money is not available to fund those tactics, not having a loyal following really hurts. After September 11th, there were customers who sent checks to Southwest Airlines to show their support. One note that accompanied a check for $1,000 read, "You've been so good to me over the years. In these hard times, I wanted to say thank you by helping you out." The checks that Southwest received were certainly not enough to make any significant impact on the company's bottom line, but they were symbolic of the feeling customers had for the brand. They had a sense of partnership. The loyal behavior of those who didn't send money is almost impossible to measure, but its impact has been invaluable over the long term, helping Southwest to maintain its position as the most profitable airline in history. Knowing you have a loyal customer and employee base not only reduces costs, it also provides massive peace of mind. Like loyal